these decisions have to be made prospectively, that the at the time that the decision is being made as to whether or not this surgery here is going to be done, then there are a lot of things that could go wrong. There are a lot of things that are in play. And so it does take, we submit, a physician in those circumstances to sort through all of that on the front end, because of the concern that if you tell somebody, here is everything that could go wrong with you in this procedure, the concern is that people will not undergo the surgeries or whatever the therapy is.
And that's where I think this feels really paternalistic. We're only going to tell you some things because we want you to have this surgery because we're going to decide what's best for you. I have a hard time with that.
Well, I think it's not deciding what's best in this situation. It's deciding how the procedure should be done. And so what happened here, of course, is you have Dr. Laples, who is using a procedure that was developed by physicians. This is state of the art as to how you close up the kidney. And so the issue here is going on the front end and trying to explain everything that possibly could go wrong and have a patient micromanage surgical technique, micromanage exactly how you're going to use the state-of-the-art technique. It seems to me there's a real concern there that you could be depriving people of a procedure that is really important to them.
In the matter that's before us, isn't that all a bit of speculation? Here, unless I misunderstand the record, Teleflex did not give a warning to the physician who performed the surgery, right?
Well, they did not.
Yes or not? That's a yes or no.
They did not warn about migration. They did as to the use of this product for ligation of vessels. They told surgeons exactly how to apply it.
But they knew about migration, didn't they?
There had been reports that they had.
But that's not what they warned the physician about, right?
They did not have the word migration in there. They did warn physicians in ligating vessels how to properly apply it and how to make sure it didn't go off.
But what we have here were clips that moved throughout a man's body and caused him, in some cases, severe pain, in other places, really significant healthcare problems because of migration, right?
Well, Your Honor, that's a matter of dispute, but it was not part of our motion. So medical causation was not what our motion was directed at. We don't agree with that, but we didn't address it because we were looking at legal causation issues in our motion.
Okay. Well, and how does your motion fit with 895.047? I don't recall your arguing that either. And that's a statute that gives manufacturers the obligation to warn consumers.
Right. So it fits with 89.047 in the sense that causation is a required element of a claim.
You still have to give the warning. You're wanting to step over the first part of the statute. I don't want you to do that. I want you to tell me how what you did fits within it.
Well, Your Honor, as to that point, I would say, although it was not the subject of our motion, because our motion was based on causation, that we did warn as to ligating vessels how it is you kept them on the vessel. And that is you clamped them, you left a cuff, a sufficient cuff that you'll see in the IFUs, which is intended to leave it in place and not have a situation. Here, of course, they weren't put on vessels. They were put on sutures in this position.
But again, you're stepping over my question because there was no warning about migration given from the manufacturer to the patient or to the physician, correct?
There was not a warning that migration would occur.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Counsel, there are a lot of different claims in this case. In the trial court, I think, dismissed basically all of them, you know, in sort of assuming that, you know, we might adopt learned intermediary doctrine. Assuming that we agreed with your argument that we can and we should, I still don't understand how that reaches all of the different claims, particularly, again, in this piggybacking off of Justice Rogenczak's question. You know, we've got a statute that the legislature drafted that governs strict liability. There's obviously claims for false advertising under 100.18. There's all kinds of different, you know, there's a manufacturing defect claim, a design defect claim. Typically, warnings may or may not be involved in that analysis. I'm trying to understand how it is that even if like the main thrust of the briefing and argument here is, you know, we can and we should adopt this for negligence type arguments in terms of the scope of what a manufacturer should warn and to whom it should warn. I don't understand how that affects the rest of these claims and what we're supposed to do with them. Could you help out on that? And particularly those claims that are governed by statute, because there really, to be frank, was very little argument about the statutory language and how we're supposed to interpret the statutory language. Obviously, the common law is one thing, but when the legislature steps in, we read the statute. That's what we do. We follow what the statute says. We don't go off and do our own thing.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. So, what happened here is, I'm going to go back, and I won't repeat everything that's in the brief in terms of Dr. Waples, what his testimony was, that there's no replacement for wet clips, this is a game changer, this is how you do the procedure, this is how everybody does something. So after his deposition, after he gave that testimony, and by the way, that he would not, he had no replacement, he wouldn't use anything else but wet clips in this procedure, after that, we went to the court and we said to the court through this motion for summary judgment that all of these claims are barred as by causation. Causation is an element of every single one of the claims, whether it's negligence, strict liability, the misrepresentation claim under 100.18, the 402B, which frankly this I'm not aware of any Wisconsin authority that's adopted that, and I don't think it's part of the statute. So we said, in this situation, they cannot prove causation on any of those claims. And what happened is, and they've never disputed that they have to prove causation, and it's their burden, that with Dr. Waples giving that testimony, they weren't going to be able to make a showing. What happened in their response is they came back and they said, oh, wait a minute, we have a defective, a manufacturing defect or a design defect claim. And we said, well, a few things. First of all, and let me go back on the 100.18. That whole representation claim that they might make under the statute, Dr. Waples was the one that was the decision maker here. This was his idea. It wasn't people buying it at Aurora Health or anything like that. He said, look, this is how you do this procedure. I want wet clips. And he made it very clear that he didn't rely upon anything from Teleflex. He never heard anything from Teleflex about that, that he made that decision, and that was part and parcel of this procedure. It comes packaged together. You can't separate the two. There's no replacement. This is what the big boys do. This is what all the national guys do. So in terms of any misrepresentation.
Some women do it too as well, right? There might be women surgeons as well who might do it, big boys and big girls perhaps.
Yeah, I'm quoting him, but okay. Fair enough. Mm-hmm. And I take your correction. So that takes care of anything in the misrepresentations, anything that are statements, whether they're statutory-based, common law-based, whether it's negligence or whether it's a failure to warn. He wasn't going to change. He was going to do it that way. Now, on the defective design and the manufacturer, the plaintiffs came back and said, oh, we've got a defective design and manufacturer claim, which, frankly, as we said in our reply, we thought was kind of diversionary, given how the case had been developed, the claims that they made, and all that. But we pointed out that, look, our motion is based on the fact that you can't prove causation on any of your claims. If you are now saying that, yes, we've got a defective design that allows us to get past summary judgment or a defective manufacturer, we said, well, you have not shown any evidence that a defective design caused the clips to migrate, or a manufacturing defect caused the clips to migrate. Our motion was based on lack of causation. If you're going to come and say that there is causation, then you need to come forward with evidence and expert evidence, and they've never disputed that, to show that the migration occurred. They didn't do it. They never asked for time to do it. They didn't do it. They never said to the court, we need more time to do it.
Was there some reason why you moved for summary judgment when discovery was still open?
Yes. After Dr. Waple's testimony that was unequivocal about how he would use those clips, and this was the only way to do it, and there was no replacement for them, we did not think there was any issue whatsoever that in the case, that we had this targeted motion on causation. We filed it on December 9th. We had a conference with the court the following day, explained what we were doing.
Was there an order in effect that required at that time the prior listing of all experts?
There was not.
Wouldn't you have expected there would be such an order in a case like this that's based on technological development?
Not necessarily.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, not an order in place. I think it was incumbent upon the plaintiff to come forward with that evidence or to make it clear why they couldn't. Neither one of those things happened.
So the plaintiffs could still name an expert because there was no order in place that gave them a date certain that had already passed, correct?
There was not. Correct. Correct. They had approximately 5 months between the time that we filed our motion on December 9th and when they filed their response on April 27th, and the case had been going on for, I think, a couple of years at that point, and they didn't present an expert.
I'm trying to think if there's anything procedurally that bars either party from seeking summary judgment or filing a motion during the time that there's discovery or a case is being worked up. I guess I've seen that on a number of occasions, and if there are still issues that need to be explored, often you hear the response that, well, we haven't deposed our expert yet, or we haven't even named experts, or there might be an answer to that asking the judge for more time before the issue is finally disposed of. Was any such requests asked for here?
No. No. The only request was for the depositions of the Aurora Health people and then three of our sales representatives, none of whom talked with Dr. Waples, only talked with the Aurora, and we're not even sure talked with the Aurora Health people, frankly, but it was, those were the, that was the discovery that was requested. So we told the court, as I said, what we were doing, you know, filed the motion, said, here's what we've got in mind. Discovery was requested by the plaintiff and allowed. That discovery did not occur either for Aurora Health or our salespeople. The reason is by the time we were dealing with people that were out of state, who were not subject to the subpoena power, we were dealing with a former employee. It took a while to get those people together. By the time we started to get things set up on that, COVID hit. And we were in a situation, and this was right in the throes of COVID. If you remember, the country's shut down about March 16th, 2020. We were talking about doing these depositions in April. They did not occur. Plaintiff did not ask for more time on that. But those depositions did not have anything to do with design or manufacturing defects. They were on the 100.18 issue, which again is Dr. Waples really as the person driving that in terms of any allegation of a representation. Might also add, in terms of the design defect, not only did they not come forward with expert evidence, but it's also true, two things, one on the design is that Dr. Waples said he wouldn't use another design. He wouldn't do anything until that was the national consensus. He had looked at other things and said, that's not what people do. This is what everybody does. I'm sticking with the wet cliffs. That's number one. Number two, and this is something we pointed out, but we relied on causation, is that the whole issue of manufacturing defect, I see my time is up.
You may finish your
may
sentence.
May I finish? Thank you.
Just your sentence.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
You may finish your sentence, but thank not you. A paragraph.
Understood. Thank you. Mr. Creve is the one who elicited testimony from Dr. Waples that all the clips properly closed, like they should.
All right.
Thank you.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. Again, my name is Jim Creva. I'm senior shareholder with the Kasdorf Law Firm in Milwaukee. I have the privilege of representing Dr. Neil Renick in a very serious product liability personal injury matter. Dr. Renick commenced this lawsuit against defendant Teleflex due to the permanent injuries he sustained and pecuniary losses that he sustained in his private solo medical practice. The claims pled in the complaint, R1 of the record in this case, are four claims. There is a common law negligence claim. There is a separate statutory strict liability products claim. There is a strict liability misrepresentation claim, number three, and there is four, the pecuniary loss statutory pecuniary damages claim based on deceptive advertising. As has been commented in court today, at least by questions, there is no law in Wisconsin that applies the physician concentric causation test that the defendant is seeking to apply for his claim of absence of causation to any of these common law claims. It simply is not the law in this state. Wisconsin is a substantial factor state. That is our causation test. It does not analyze injury and damage causation from the perspective of a physician and a physician alone. That is done in some states that have adopted and strictly apply a very strict version of the learned intermediary doctrine. That is not the law in Wisconsin. It has never been the law of causation in this state.
So are you arguing against us adopting the learned intermediary doctrine?
Pardon me?
I didn't get this from your brief. And so my question is, Mr. Peck and filings, they give us all the reasons that we should adopt the learned intermediary doctrine. And I didn't read your filings to say, please don't do that. I don't know if that's what you're arguing today or not, but I'm interested in what your position is.
I believe that there is potentially, with legislative guidance or on the court's own direction, an opportunity in some facts and some cases to craft an appropriate specie of learned intermediary doctrine. What I suggest is this is not the case to do it with the facts that are unique to this case that are uncontested in the record. The essence of the learned intermediary doctrine calls on a manufacturer of a medical device to share its knowledge of dangerous injury-causing potential in its product with the learned intermediary doctor. That is the essence of learned intermediary doctrine. In this case, it is an uncontested fact that although this defendant had actual knowledge that its Hemolock clip product on a recurrent basis was migrating and causing patient complication injuries in some patients, not all patients, but in some patients on a recurrent basis, and it concealed that risk. It did not share it with the medical community. It didn't tell Dr. Rennick, the surgeons who insert and surgically implant the products. It didn't tell the hospitals that buy its products, and it certainly never told Dr. Rennick, the patient who received 28 to 32 of these put into his body without any advance knowledge that this product had that potential to injure.
I think your friends on the other...
Please.
Okay. I have one question.
Okay. Are you sure?
I think.
One?
Well, I don't know. We'll see.
Okay.
Don't hold me to it. This is my question. I think what your friends on the other side would say is, even if the doctor had received the warnings, he still was going to use the clips in this procedure. So
that's an interesting question because, well, perhaps you didn't finish your question.
No, I'm being held to one question and I'm sticking with it. I got five colleagues holding me accountable.
This doctor, after hours of depositions about what he knew and did not know about this specific product and why he uses it and how he uses it, gave a very candid deposition testimony admission. And in this testimony, and it's in the record, he said, in answering defense question, you know, perhaps this is something that I should disclose. That is his sworn testimony in this record that is in the opposition record on summary judgment. This doctor, by his own testimony, has questioned whether, based on what he knows now about these clips, whether this is something that should be shared with patients. The patient in this case is himself a licensed physician in Wisconsin. If there is somebody that is capable of understanding the arguments and receiving the warning and making a rational, informed consent surgical decision to proceed or not proceed, it is my client, Dr. Rennick. He was deprived of his opportunity to exercise informed consent to this operation, placing 28 to 32 of these never tested in human being clips into his body because Teleflex didn't tell his doctor these clips can migrate, they have a recurrent problem in this regard, and Teleflex didn't supply to his doctor the safety instructions as to how you recognize, diagnose, and timely and properly treat the patients that have these foreseeable complications caused by migration. Why did Teleflex choose to conceal and hold this information to itself instead of sharing it with the medical community that purchases and uses its products?
Counsel, and I ask this question seriously, are you finished answering the question of Justice Karofsky, or are you going into a new area? It sounded like you were going into a new area.
I think I'm finished.
I think so.
So I'm going to follow up on Justice Karofsky's question. And she asked, you know, were you arguing against, in part she asked, are you arguing against adopting this doctrine? And you responded with,
not
it
here.
Wasn't yes or no, like science.
It was, I don't know, but not here.
That's right. That's exactly. And maybe it was just, I do know, but not here. And that's kind of what I heard. I think, and all the lawyers here will know, that when you talk about limitations of duty in common law, you start with what case? You start with the Paul's Graph case, right? And so that's where I start when I look at this doctrine of limiting the duty. Here, the doctrine holds the manufacturer of a prescription drug or medical device fulfills its duty to warn of the product's risk by informing the prescribing physician of those risks. So there is a limitation on duty. And Paul's graph, of course, Wisconsin, which has been repeated in our jurisprudence, adopts the minority approach in Paul's graph, Andrews' approach, Judge Andrews, not Cardozo's majority opinion. And I think, arguably, that the adoption of this doctrine, maybe other jurisdictions have done it, I don't know where those other jurisdictions fall on how they see negligence. We clearly fall on the dissent on Andrews. And I think under Andrews, you can't adopt this. The quintessential difference, a quintessential difference between the majority and the dissent is the timing. Cardozo would limit it at the very beginning. Motion to dismiss, motion to suppress. The court decides whether or not you're going to go forward with it. And as I see Andrews, and I might be wrong, it is on causation. It's different. It allows the jury, in fact, an explanation would be thus, that under the Andrews theory, the jury first determines the elements of negligence, including causation, and the verdict is subject to review for possible judicial limitation unless the jury itself finds a lack of the requisite causation, proximate cause. So let's take, for purposes of argument, that adoption of this doctrine is antithetical to the dissent in Paul's graph. Should that be a consideration? And if you haven't thought about it, that's okay too.
In Wisconsin,
you know, we're different. Wisconsin, we're different here.
Every person owes
like that way.
Every other person.
That's
a
right.
Duty to exercise reasonable care.
And you probably got an A because that's exactly the words of Andrews. We have the duty to the world, everyone.
Correct.
Okay.
And applying that duty to the world in this case, this defendant had a duty to my client to tell them about a risk that it knows about inherent in its product, and it did not do so. Nor did it tell the physician to qualify as a duty exception under any variant of learned intermediary. It failed in both regards. It didn't tell my client, the end user patient. It didn't tell the physician, who is the learned intermediary surgeon who installs it.
Are you able to answer this question, yes or no, and maybe not? Not every question falls into that category. Is your position here today that in certain circumstances the doctrine should be adopted by this court? Is your position consistent with Wisconsin's view of negligence set forth in the dissent in Paul's graph?
I will try to answer that question this way. I will say Wisconsin absolutely not should accept and adopt a learned intermediary doctrine in any case for any medical product in which the manufacturer has not warned of a known danger, which is the uncontested facts in this case. So, should this case be a basis to adopt learned intermediary doctrine in the state of Wisconsin? I will answer that firmly, no. Might there be some other case, some other day, some other time, with a manufacturer who made a much better effort to comply with and follow its duty of disclosure of injury warnings and instructions? Perhaps
So why?
But that is not this case.
Why are you hinging it on that the warning? Because in my reading of Zimmer, the Seventh Circuit case, my understand the facts of that case, that there was also no warning in that case, correct? And so why is that the tipping point for you?
Actually, there was a warning in that case. There was a warning about cement. There was an instruction to use cement. It was a more applicable case for potential application for learned intermediary because the debate was how much cement should the product use. That's so different, Your
right,
Honor,
hold,
from
hold
this
on.
Case.
Let me back up. Right, I misstated, and I should state it right, that what the court held in Zimmer was that if properly warned, the doctor, it had to do with whether or not the doctor would alter his or her behavior, correct? And in this case, my understanding is that even if warned, the doctor was not going to alter his behavior. He still was going to use the clips. So I'm just trying to understand why that's the tipping point for you.
This doctor has suggested, or at least raised a jury inference from which a reasonable jury can take competing inferences when he testifies, perhaps this is something I should discuss.
Okay, so you're not accepting, and I understand why, you're not accepting as a fact in this case, you're saying that would go to the jury as to whether or not the doctor...
Exactly. I do not accept the fact that they have proven with certainty justifying summary judgment the absence of causation and that he would not alter his behavior.
Okay, so now help me connect that dot to what Justice Ann Wallace Bradley just asked you, which I think is a 30,000-foot view of, if I'm misstating, please let me know.
She will.
Yeah, and I'll never be able to say it as articulately as she could. Is the 30,000-foot view of how does this case fit or how does it not fit into the LID?
Into the Paul's Graf exception minority rule? Paul's Graf's exception, the Wisconsin rule, that everyone owes a duty of reasonable conduct to everyone in the world, supports my client's common law negligence claim, it supports my client's product liability statutory claim, and it supports its misrepresentation claim.
Yeah, but, I mean, there are limitations. I don't mean to suggest there aren't limitations. Everyone owes a duty, and then, you know, that would be horrible, wouldn't it? I mean, there are limitations. Causation, proving causation is
there are causation.
There
and there are the causation limitations inherent in every tort case, every negligence case. And I would go to the record that my client put into the record. There is substantial evidence that Teleflex acts and omissions are a significant factor cause of my client's injuries and damages. That satisfies the Wisconsin standard, tort standard. It will satisfy the duty to everyone in the world of reasonable standard. My client has four causes of action grounded, well grounded in Wisconsin causes of action, which should go forward and present jury questions.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the facts? Because at summary judgment, material issues of fact are important. From the one perspective, they introduce evidence that even if there's a duty, even if there's a breach, even if there's harm, isn't that middle part, that causation, that's important. Because I think they say that the doctor said, regardless of a warning, I already knew these things migrated. I knew this could happen, and I was going to use them anyway. What is in the record from your side to say, no, that's a contested fact. We need to go to trial on that, and there's a material issue of fact.
The plaintiff's opposition brief has extensive argument in it built around the contents and the substance of Dr. Neil Rennick's own affidavit. that effectively walks action by action through what happened to him and connects the causation, what happened to him and what he would do differently had he been told and warned. It satisfies the causation warning test for negligence in this state, and it creates jury issues of fact. I'd like to turn, if I can, if I've answered your question sufficiently. The suggestion that the plaintiff on this motion had a burden to come forward with expert testimony to substantiate the design defect claim and the other aspects of a strict liability claim, that is, it's nonsense. A scheduling order requiring disclosure of the plaintiff's experts, liability experts, had never been issued in this case.
Right. So your response would be, presumably, hey, Judge, we don't even have a scheduling order. We need more time to work up this case. There are genuine issues of material fact. I could even submit some affidavits in that regard. But let us work up the case first before you decide the summary judgment motion, right?
Those arguments were made, Your Honor. And I suggest looking at, I can't pull them by memory, but there are citations to the records of my comments to the trial court stating exactly that.
So you asked for an adjournment?
We haven't even closed fact discovery, much less touched on expert discovery.
I understand that, but summary judgment motions happen before cases are concluded because they are intended to perhaps abbreviate all of the expense and things that go on in trials and eliminate cases that aren't properly before a court and allow cases that are to go forward. So I'm trying to figure out. I mean, it's not as if you can't bring a summary judgment motion. You've brought summary judgment motions before discovery is completely done or expert witness lists are submitted, right? There's no time limit. But then you say to the judge, because the judge wants all the facts so you know you're deciding it correctly. You say, hey, we haven't properly worked this case up. Did you do that?
And that's why I made an oral motion in front of the judge under the state statute that permits a party to request additional discovery and additional time to oppose. That was made in this case.
So that's the judge's error to have denied that.
The judge never ruled on that.
Okay.
The judge never ruled on that. Initially he granted certain depositions, fact witnesses that would really address more the misrepresentation causes of action. The issue of no expert testimony on the product defect, that was never raised in the defendant's motion. The motion says Teleflex is entitled to judgment on all of plaintiff's claims because plaintiff cannot establish that any alleged act or omission by Teleflex caused his alleged injuries. That's the sole basis on which they moved. That's the exact basis that my client, in his summary judgment opposition submissions, presented affidavits, evidence showing alternative reasonable design, at least to the extent we had it at that time, and presented causation issues of fact as to how their product and their conduct, including the failure of warnings, contributed to his injury. As the Court of Appeals expressly ruled in this case, they found material disputes of fact and issues of fact on all those points based on our opposition submission. That is the correct resolution of this case, essentially to follow the guidance of the Court of Appeals that this is not a summary judgment case due to material disputed issues of fact on liability, causation, and all issues on all causes of action. That's what they decided. And they said specifically, the facts of this case do not fit the learned intermediary doctrine. That was my argument to the trial court. That was my argument to the Court of Appeals, that because no warnings were provided by this manufacturer to the doctor or to the plaintiff himself, It doesn't fit the traditional understanding of learned intermediary.
Counsel, what you describe in your brief and just now about the nature of how the learned intermediary doctrine is applied nationwide, I don't think is correct. I think opposing counsel is correct about the way it operates in practice and about the way courts that have adopted it play it out. It's not an affirmative defense. When you're looking at causation, you look at what the doctor would do. I have some real concern that, and obviously some of my colleagues have expressed some skepticism about what we should do or can do under these circumstances. I'm trying to think about what a rule is that comes out of this case that would give any guidance here, because the idea that, anytime anybody might get a surgery, that if warnings weren't given to the physician about the way, laparoscopic tools work, or the anesthesia that might be used, or those sorts of things, that those warnings need to be given to, the patient, and if those warnings aren't given, then they can be liable if something goes wrong. It seems that there is a potential dramatic expansion of liability. Like, there's an open question about what the law is in this area, about how you prove causation. I don't think it's enough to say maybe we don't go this way or go that way. I don't know what the rule is. I don't even know what the rule is you're advocating for, because what you're advocating for, at least as I read it, is totally inconsistent with the way courts around the country apply, at least almost all of them, that's not the way the learned intermediary doctrine works. It goes to the scope of duty in cases that might be non-Andrews dissent cases, or potentially towards the nature of how you prove causation in maybe Andrews dissent cases or adopted by the legislature. So could you help us out here? Because some rule is going to come out of this, and I have some real concern that we might mess things up here and make the law less clear for courts and for juries. I'm trying to think of how judges are supposed to instruct juries in some of these questions, because those things are all affected by how injuries are caused and what the legal analysis is in this area.
I think my time is up.
No, it's not. You've got somewhere within 5 minutes.
That's just a yellow light. You're all good. Yeah.
One of my arguments in my prepared outline that I haven't got to today was to suggest that this may be a case that calls for a reasoned exercise of judicial discretion to not apply learned intermediary doctrine under the facts of this case, because they are so inapplicable, where the manufacturer has made no effort to warn anyone, not the doctor, not the hospital, or not the patient. It's just bad facts make bad law.
But again,
that's an adage.
I'm sorry, I just want to jump in. That's how the learned intermediary doctrine works around the country. If there is no failure to warn, it doesn't mean you're liable. It goes to how you prove causation at the end of the day. Who do you look at? So you can't just say, I think, there was no warning given to anybody, ergo we throw it out the door and the warning needs to be given to the patient. That's precisely where these questions come in.
Justice Sykes, in her Seventh Circuit decision, which has been cited by Teleflex, cited by the trial court, expressly states, and I've quoted the quote verbatim in my brief. I don't have it in memory. But the essence of what Justice Sykes decided, or what she wrote, is that the learned intermediary doctrine applies where the manufacturer provides an adequate warning of the known danger to the prescribing medical professional. That is the quote from her decision. That is an apt summary of...
But she goes on to say, but the failure to warn must also establish causation by showing that if properly warned, he or she would have altered behavior and avoided injury. That's just a couple paragraphs below. I think your site is paragraph 751, and this is at 754, or page 754.
Yes.
So it gets back to the causation question that I'm hearing Justice Hagedorn ask you.
It's back to the causation question on the issue of where do we use and apply this physician-concentric causation, and the only place that it reasonably would be applied, if it's to be applied in Wisconsin, is on the issue of failure to warn liability. The issue doesn't exist for the rest of the cause of actions pled in this case of negligence, of product defect, of strict product misrepresentation. The essence of plaintiff's first pled cause of action, common law negligence, is seeking liability because Teleflex sold and marketed an unsafe product never tested in human beings, and then misadvertised the safety, the reliability, and the performance of this product. That's the essence of what the negligence claim has been built around.
So are you saying, in response to Justice Hagedorn's question, just to cut to the quick here, that in a situation where there has not been a warning, the LID should not come into play?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. How are you going to merge the decades of Wisconsin tort law?
You two get a sentence, not a paragraph.
I'll withdraw it. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you.
I'd like to start with the question posed by Justice Hagedorn. How do you come out of this with a test for trial courts? And the test is that in a situation where prescription medical products and medical devices are involved, the duty to warn is to the physician, the healthcare provider. Bright line test, that's what the learned intermediary doctrine is all about. It is about, and that is what was articulated by Judge Sykes, when she said, we're going to join everybody else, which is, as you pointed out, Justice Hagedorn, that's the rule of law. And that is what we are advocating here. If then a plaintiff can prove that the warning was inadequate, whether absence or inadequate, and we've cited cases, and so has the amicus, showing there's no differentiation on that in terms of the application of the learned intermediary doctrine, and the plaintiff can prove causation, then the plaintiff can prevail in its action.
Mr. Peck, is there any distinction that we should think about drawing between devices that are implanted in someone and drugs? Because it seems to me that every time I go to the pharmacy or pick up something for a member of my family, there's lots and lots of information that is, you know, in the package from Walgreens. And this case, obviously, is about something that a medical implant. And are you asking us just to group it all together, or should we think about parsing it out?
The courts have not distinguished, and I don't think, as long as it is something that is prescribed by a physician, Justice, I believe that the learned intermediary doctrine should apply to both sets of products.
We probably wouldn't need to decide that in order to decide this case, though, however, correct? There might be times or places where there are exceptions. There are some jurisdictions have some exceptions. I think what you're asking us to do is to adopt it for the purposes of this particular product, as used in this particular case.
That is correct, Justice Hagedorn. If the decision was made that it was going to only be in this case, that would be an appropriate result from Teleflex's standpoint, but it has been adopted with respect to prescription drugs as well. I did want to address a question that Justice Bradley posed about the whole issue of pulse graph and the influence here and how that and I have two thoughts on that. One is, number one, New York has adopted the learned intermediary doctrine, where pulse graph came out. And what it recognized is that even in situations with the duty is owed to the public at large, there are limitations, as I believe Justice Ziegler identified. And I believe, Justice Bradley, you did as well. And that is something that this court pointed out in Hocking, saying that while Wisconsin follows the minority view from Paul's graph, the duty owed to the world is not unlimited, but rather is restricted to what is reasonable under the circumstances. This represents a situation where the duty going to the physician is reasonable under the circumstances and applies well.
Reasonable under the circumstances, just another way of saying a usual word is like limiting liability under public policy because it's too causation is too remote. Is that a fancy way of saying, well, I can limit causation because it's too remote? In essence, it's reasonable under the circumstances. Are you using those terms synonymous?
I'm sorry. Were you finished? I'm not using it to limit liability in any sense. What I'm using it is to define to whom the duty is owed. Mm-hmm. If the plaintiff can prove that the duty was not discharged, that the warning was not adequate and there was causation, can still recover. It's not a limitation of any liability. Instead, it is a direction of to whom the duty is owed as opposed to the public at large.
And the duty, under your argument, is the duty to warn.
Correct.
Is owed to the physician.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. And not to the public at large.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. I'd like to... I see my time is up.
Not even a sentence this time. All right. Thank you for oral arguments. This is very interesting. The court will adjourn. Counselor, properly positioned for that.